You need to balance both the business metrics, return on investment, and also the capacity of the network to be able to serve those customers right. In AI, it's not a cycle of a couple of years, it's a cycle of months, if not weeks. There's new discoveries every single day. If you're in that field, you're already passionate about AI, you already know about the new technologies. 99% of business problems can be enhanced or helped with data. We're collecting so much data today.
Welcome to the CAIO podcast, where we delve deep into the world of chief AI officers, exploring their journeys, insights, and challenges in steering AI initiatives within their organization. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are honored to have Alexander Guilbeault with us. Alex is the head of AI for TELUS, a leading telecommunications company from Canada with over $20 billion in revenues. Join us as we uncover the secrets to his success, the obstacles he has faced, and the wisdom he has gained along the way. Alex, welcome to the CAIO podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be here today and discuss with you, Sanjay.
Wonderful. Alex, our audience is a global audience, but it is also an audience made up of your peers, of people who are looking to follow in your footsteps, and people who are looking to potentially join your company. So as I told you before, the objective is inspire, attract, and communicate and collaborate with your colleagues. So keeping that in mind, can you tell our audience about your journey and what inspired you to becoming the head of AI at TELUS?
Yeah, for sure. So I graduated from electrical engineering, specialized in telecommunication and software. And my first job was actually already at TELUS. I joined as a RF engineer in the capacity field. So our goal was to predict which antenna will require new upgrades or new frequencies in the next 10 years, because it takes a lot of time to do that. We need to be really precise on when we'll require new additions to the network. So I've been already in the data field, already in the telecommunication field from the beginning. I've been doing that for a couple of years, then started some businesses. I worked as a project manager as well, and then decided to do an MBA. And I think that was a turning point in my career, because during this MBA in Montreal, there's been a big release, a big new wave of interest for AI. It was around 2015, and that's when we heard the full blast that deep learning has been doing on the industry. So since I was in a full-time MBA and had the opportunity to go and meet people, go to conferences, I started to be really involved in the AI community in Montreal. So I volunteered in various organizations, been to various conferences, met a lot of people, and I pushed to do an internship at a company that was back then called Element AI. So I spent some time with AI researchers. I spent some time with business development folks in that industry, met a lot of businesses, and I really found my passion even more in everything software and artificial intelligence. While I was at it, I saw a posting for the same job I was doing before at TELUS, but with a tweak now. So it was capacity engineer with data scientist experience. So I felt that I could be the best candidate for that. I haven't mentioned that before, but capacity engineering has also a business lens. Anytime you want to do a new unlimited plan, for example, or do new sales in a new area, you need to balance both the business metrics, return on investment, and also the capacity of the network to be able to serve those customers right. So it was really a mix of the master degree I was doing in business with the engineering and the data science part of it. So I really found my my right spot there. So I joined back TELUS. It was about 6 or 7 years ago. I can't even remember. And I started back to do capacity engineering, but with a more data science toolkit, more AI in the forecasting that we were doing. And within the first year, we've proven that with advanced AI, we could have massive saving in the range of tens of millions every year because we're just more precise in every formatting we're doing. Due to that, we started to build a team around AI. So we started with around 5 people, quickly grew to 10, 15. I became the manager of that team, and we were always outcome driven, so we could grow fast and prove to the business that it had some value. And six years later, we're now a team of 50 AI engineers, and we're not just tackling network, we're actually helping every business unit across TELUS.
Wow, amazing journey. Now, Alex, as I told you, there are people who are listening to this who want to be in your shoes, chief AI officer. So you've been an entrepreneur, you've been an intern, you got a business degree, and then you came back to your company and you cover a wide variety, as you said, data science, you do business, a whole range. So this is very helpful to our listeners. And now you have a team of 50 AI scientists working for you. So that is pretty incredible. One thing, Alex, because our audience is global, in North America as well as outside, can you give a very brief overview of what TELUS is? I know what TELUS is because I've been to. You can't be in Canada and not know what TELUS is if you want to communicate. But just, you know, for listeners in Asia and Latin America, South America, Africa, could you please tell them what TELUS is?
For sure, it will be hard to even be brief here because TELUS expanded in so many different fields now. But it is mainly a telecom. By history, it's a telecom company, so we're offering internet, wireline services, phones, mobile services, home solution as well, some home automation, home security. But we also expanded in other fields. We see ourselves more as a tech company now, more than a telco company. Some of our big divisions are TELUS Health, so we're providing healthcare a solution. We're providing insurance. We have also TELUS Agriculture that is providing services for farmers, services to transport and optimize the full supply chain of food. We have also our division that is now a spin-off that is called TELUS International that does TI services, a bunch of other things around the world. So really, we see ourselves more than a telco now. It's really a tech company.
Wow. So, but a large tech company with $20 billion in revenues, right?
Yeah, indeed.
That's wonderful. Alex, what inspired you? This is, again, for listeners who want to be towards the field of artificial intelligence. Obviously, right now, it is the thing. It is the moment. It is everybody. I can't wake up and not see at least 100 emails talking about AI or pick up a newspaper or stuff. But what inspired you to get into AI?
I think one of the reason is actually the same reason why I've been interested in telecommunication. What I love about telecommunication is that it's evolving so fast. You can never become an expert and just sit on your laurels. When I first joined, we were speaking about moving from HSP to HSP plus and then LTE, and we're already in 5G. So every 2-3 years, you need to relearn all the technologies. While I'm even better served in AI, it's not a cycle of a couple of years, it's a cycle of months, if not weeks. There's new discoveries every single day, new products out there. So you need to keep on learning. You need to be a lifelong learner. And I think that's one of the key things I love about that field. You can never just be an expert and share your tuition value. You need to remain humble and you need to keep on reading and be interested into that. So it might be early to already say that, but if I had an advice to give to anybody that would like to get into this field, don't go into this just because there's not a hype right now. Go into this because you're really passionate about it. If you're not, it will be tough to keep on reading about that, keep on going to conferences, keep on asking questions and reinvent yourself. That's something that is both amazing, but can be also stressful for some people.
So I think you make some very important points for our listeners. You are curious about things. You spend time on self-learning. A lot of our guests talk about how much time they spend in a day in just in learning about things. And as you said, if you're curious about it, go into it, don't go into it for the hype. So that, I think, is very, very helpful for our listeners. Alex, as you mentioned early on, you have a large team of 50 AI scientists, and we'll come to that part later, as people know how hard it is to even get one, and Alex has got 50. Tell our listeners about some of the challenges and opportunities that you have encountered while creating this ecosystem of AI within TELUS.
Yeah, this is a really good question. And indeed, it is difficult to attract talent. But something that helps us a little bit is, I think, talent attract talent. Again, given that how fast this field is moving, if you're only having one data scientist in the team, he will have a hard time reading everything happening out there, keeping himself up to date. But if you have 5 or 10, together they can collaborate on like looking at everything that there is out there, listening to videos, going to conferences, reading newsletter. And together, if they're really they have the culture of sharing and helping each other to grow, I think the better spot for any data scientist is within a big data science team. So I think there's a critical mass you need to reach. And I'm throwing a number here, but I guess this is around maybe 10 to 15 people. Once you reach that, it's much easier to attract talent. So I didn't start from just one or two data scientists. As I've mentioned before, we were 5, 6. So it was a challenge to move from 6 to 10, 15. But once we reach this critical mass, there's a lot of people interested to joining our group because they will keep on learning. One thing we're doing, for example, is you've mentioned how much time we're spending on keeping ourselves updated. Personally, I'm spending between 30 minutes to 45 minutes every single day reading about news out there. I wish I could spend more, but there's so much that I can't cover everything myself. Neither can my team. So what we're doing right now is we're doing a TLDR session on Friday. So we have one person per week that takes more time to review all the news happening in the week and present that to the 50 other AI engineers in the team. And that really helped us to keep ourselves updated on everything happening. So again, down to the point I'm trying to make here, I think talent attracts talent. Getting to this critical mass is the challenge. So to attract those people before, you need to really have a compelling vision. You have to have a compelling North Star. You need to also give them the flexibility to build that and make this team their own. So it's not about giving them a clear guidelines, a clear objective, but more about creating something altogether. I think that helps attract young talents.
So again, Alex, I hate to keep saying it, but you made some excellent points here for our audience. So I just want to mention talent attracts talent. And you said you need to have some kind of a group or some kind of critical mass. And in your view, that is about 15 or so. And then I thought this was a great point you made, and I'm going to try to see if we can do this. Is you take you do a TLDR on Friday and you assign somebody. So what it does is it puts the onus on that person to learn, but it also puts the onus on everybody else to learn, and that's a great thing. And also it's a team building exercise. In terms of since we are on the topic of talent, which is now you know, so critical, and for listeners, you know, and we will talk why TELUS is such a great place to work, why he has been able to attract talent. Where do you look for talent? Is it universities, other places, or everywhere? Because, you know, we've discussed this, Alex. You have people who are coming out of great universities, and Montreal has some fantastic universities. Toronto has some great universities. There are some other people fighting for those talents like Google and OpenAI and DeepMind and Microsoft and others. What has been that secret sauce? Maybe you don't want to tell all the secret sauce, but maybe at least 70-80% to our listeners who are fighting that battle in terms of attracting that talent.
And indeed, this is a really good question. We did lose some talent to those big firms before. They are able to pay much higher. In US dollar, in Canada, it makes a big change, especially given right now we have remote working culture almost everywhere. So those big firms do hire in Canada with a lot of incentive for employees to go there. I think that
also stock options, as you know, Alex.
It makes a big difference for sure.
Big difference, yeah.
So we do have transparent conversation about that with some of our employees. Some are thinking about it eventually. So they see our team as a platform to get them started, to learn about various industries, various fields. They can touch many different technologies. So sometimes they use that as a jump start. To get to those eventually, and that's fine. We want the best for them. I think that's also one way to attract talent, because we really care about them and we care about their own growth, and we're happy if ever they go there. But something that they find and tell us that they wouldn't be able to find in those other firms, speaking to some that already left and hearing how their journey is going, they are not able to touch as many technologies. They are not able to touch as many industries. They're not able to touch as many different stakeholders. They are more in a silo if they join those big organization. Just to give an example, one data scientist used to work with across various business units, sales, engineering, marketing, really cutting edge technologies, solving real important business challenges. And now in the company he joined for a better salary, so he's happy for sure, but he's doing only data science on the cell component of their website. So that's really specific. So the job alone is not as interesting as doesn't give as much growth to learn and expand yourself and reinvent yourself. So I think there's a big plus in being in a big industry that touches many different fields and many different technologies as well.
No, so I think what Alex is saying is, hey, if you work at some of these tech companies, and they're all great companies, in some cases they are partners of Alex in many instances, but you get to explore and challenge yourself with many different things rather than being in a silo. Alex, that's a great point. What kind of people do you look for? What skills do you look for in terms of the people that you're bringing on? Now, this is also for listeners who are thinking of Talos as an opportunity.
For sure, you need to have some technical background, but I wouldn't say this is my most important priority. Given the fact that this field is moving extremely fast, if somebody is an expert at one technology, maybe this technology will be a legacy in a couple of months. So we don't care as much about the technical knowledge, but more about the passion, a willingness to always learn more, develop yourself, reinvent yourself. Humility is extremely important. And I think soft skills is sometimes even more important. So that's something sometimes people might not think about because it's a really technical field. But being a fast learner, a good problem solver, having a business savvy mindset, and good communication skills are extremely important as well. So I would say you need to have a minimum of coding experience, but you need mostly to show your passion for the field, your willingness to learn, reinvent yourself, to collaborate with others. It's more about the culture and your approach to working than the technical knowledge.
So I think you're saying that the soft skills, you know, the data science is a given, but I think what you're saying is the soft skills, the self-starter, the willingness to learn, collaborate, those things become really the defining or the differentiator for the people that you're hiring. So that's a great point. Alex, tell our audience what are your views on mentorship? Do you believe, and again, as people who are looking to get onto this journey, all of us have had mentors in some shape or form. It can be family, they can be professors, they can be colleagues, etc. But as you're getting into this role, have you had a mentor? And what do you suggest to our listeners in terms of what should they be looking at?
Yeah, I think having a mentor is extremely important to push yourself further, to challenge a little bit the way you're thinking. I personally never had a mentor in this specific field, and I think it was actually an advantage. I think the fact to have a mentor that is, for example, in marketing field, in finance, will have a completely different perception of stuff around you and can challenge a little bit the way you're thinking. If you're in that field, you're already passionate about AI, you already know about the new technologies. So you need to be challenged about how to apply those, how to communicate in a way that other people will understand, people that might not be technical at all. So I've been having a couple of mentors for my career really helped me to challenge myself, to figure out what I need to improve upon, rethink a little bit my perceptions. And I do believe those are essentials. Personally, never had someone in this specific field. Maybe there are some pros and cons, but personally, I did enjoy the fact that I had different perspectives.
Wonderful. Alex, tell our audience about some of the ways AI is being currently used, and tell us some of the exciting things, if somebody were to come and join, some of the things that are making difference for the customers, because ultimately it's about really the customers, right?
Indeed. TELUS is always customer first and having a positive impact on our customers and all Canadians. We have so many things. It's always hard to figure out which one will be the most interesting. Since we're getting into Earth Month, I'm thinking we're about some of the use cases we drove for sustainability that we opened open source and shared with the community in partnership with Vector Institute. So two that I can share here is first, we created a HVAC optimization system. So we used reinforcement learning to optimize room cooling or room heating in our data centers, achieving 15% cost efficiencies on those. It's about forecasting, getting access to forecasts of the weather, and then proactively heat or cool room, taking into account how the temperature will change later. So this is giving us a big savings for our data centers, and we release that openly. So this is an open source project. Anybody can take the code and bring that to their own organization. We also did some computer vision for recognizing forest. What are the different type of trees? If some sections are more dry, so to prevent forest fires, and we've experienced a lot in the last year and probably this year as well. So that's another thing we released openly and co-developed with Vector Institute. In terms of stuff we're doing internally in the last year, with all the new hype and wave of interest around generative AI, we created a platform where people can create internally copilots in a really secure manner. They have access to all the LLMs actually through this platform, but we have a proxy layer where we can make sure that everything is private, secure for our customers to use, and ensure there can't be any data breaches from any of those partners we're having. And through this platform, we've been able to generate a lot of use cases across the organization. So we have currently around 15 in production generative AI models. Whenever you want to to question the HR group for holidays or for a question about your pay, you can just chat directly with Copilot there. We have the same thing for IT. We deploy that as well in the call centers. So our agent have access to all the repository information they have with just a question. Normally, they had 100K pages they had to go through to find information on a specific client need, either on their plan or on their devices or network issues. Now they can just ask the question directly and see the summarized answer that they can get to the customer. We have the same thing for a sell. We have also some that are customer facing. People can self-serve if they have some question on our website. So on generative AI, it's been a really a big boom in the last year. And this platform, we're actually starting to sell it externally. So it's called FuelIX. We're actually serving other companies to have the same proxy installed and on top application that they can develop for their own. So we're really democratizing this technology, making sure anybody, even without technical skills, can create their own copilot to help them out, upload documents, ask questions about those documents. So I think this project around generative AI is quite compelling and quite interesting. Because we see a usage around 15,000 every single day on those platforms, and we really see the gains that this is providing to every single employee. Without going into everything we're doing, I think we have over 100 projects that are in production right now, but we do a lot of what I would call classical machine learning. I hate that term because it's generative AI didn't replace that. It's still really important, but we still do a lot of projects around fraud detection, around recommendation engine, about proactive care on the network, understanding users' perception of the network. So we do a lot of different projects in a lot of different fields.
Well, that's fantastic. So for our listeners, Alex touched, and it's not, as he said, he's got about 100 projects. Given that Earth Day is coming up, sustainability in terms of HVAC, reducing of CO2s, he's talking about identifying forests and also internal applications, whether it's in HR, whether it's in customer support, and obviously the traditional bread and butter of recommendations and fraud detection, etc. So you've got a lot going on, Alex. As a follow-on question, because we had the chief AI officer of Qualcomm, and we have spoken also to Telefonica, what are your thoughts on the small form factor of LLMs on devices? Any thoughts on that? Because that's where Qualcomm is working on. And as you know, there are a lot of people, including Apple and others, working on that. Give our listeners some your perspective on that.
Yeah, that will be interesting. I feel often in that field, the use case follow the technology. So sometimes it's about ensuring that this technology is out there and giving it in the hands of multiple developers. That gives tons of ideas and generate really new application that we couldn't even think about before. We've seen that with various other technologies before. I think LLM integrated into devices will do the same. And something that is powerful about that is you don't need to have the most powerful model to do amazing things. Many of the use cases I've been mentioning before are actually leveraging RAG, so retrieval augmented generation. And that's about just finding the right information, not AI-based. It's really about vector comparison, finding where the information you're looking for is located, and just asking the LLM to summarize it in the specific context of a user. So having an LLM integrated into a device, even if it's a smaller LLM, can already provide so much help to the end user without the need for those super massive models that we're having out there.
That's great. So are you using any open source models, or is it mainly closed source, Alex? And what are your thoughts on open source versus closed source?
I think this field has been seeing this huge development in the last 10 years because of open source. I'm so impressed about how the willingness from the other community to share good practices, to co-develop together. I think we're seeing a revolution in the last, I would say, 20 years. And a lot of people are using Wikipedia as an example. Like, nobody would have thought 30 years ago that the best encyclopedia would actually be done by collaboration across the world and not by a big business out there. So I do fully believe that open source is the way to accelerate, democratize, and help the full world to leverage those technologies instead of keeping this in the hands of a few big techs. We're using actually everything. As I've mentioned before, to this proxy layer, we're trying to integrate all the LLMs that are available either through API access or hosting open source models through it. So yeah, we do use open source and closed source models. Right now, we're mainly leveraging GPT models from OpenAI through Microsoft, through Azure, because they're really cheap to use and quite powerful. And for most of the use case that we're having today, we don't need to go into the most advanced models. 3.5 serves 99% of our needs without even the need to go to GPT-4.
Wonderful. English and French or just English?
Both. Both. We always need to have French integrated in Canada for sure. Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So you have an awesome team. You told our audience what are the qualities of people that you look for, some of the amazing projects that you have. How do you foster a culture of innovation and experimentation within your group? Because some of these people who are coming in, you know, as you said, you're not keeping silos, but they want to feel entrepreneurial. Is there an opportunity for that?
Totally. I have so much to say about that. I'll try to be brief. What we're trying to hire is intrapreneur. So people that really will co-develop with us this business unit. We have a culture of fail fast. We do believe that in this field, you don't know. It's a toss of a coin when you start a project if it will be successful or not. And the reason for that is not necessarily the technology. Sometimes it's about change management, people willingness to embark on this, change of priorities, privacy concerns or security concerns, the data readiness. So when you start a project, you're not sure it will be successful or not. What we're trying to avoid is having somebody fail in a project after 6 months or a year. We prefer them to fail, but fail fast. So whenever we start a project, we're trying to figure out what's the weakest link. So for example, if we start a project and we're not sure if it will be okay for security or privacy reasons, let's tackle that first. Let's go get help from the privacy office and the security office and let us know straight up if it might be a success or not. If it's data, we'll tackle data first. If it's a change management, we'll make sure that we have a change owner in the business unit impacted and make sure that we have their buy-in. So it's really about finding the weakest link, testing it out. And if we are to fail, let's fail in the first couple of days so that we can move on to the next best project. It's about considering the cost of opportunity of everything we're doing. Also, to create a fail fast culture, you need to be open for errors. You don't innovate if you don't make mistakes. So you constantly need to work on against a culture of blaming. We don't want to ever hear somebody blame. We need to recognize an error. We need to dig into this error to understand why there was an error, to get some tuition value out of that. But who made it is irrelevant in the discussion we're having. So I think setting this safe environment to fail, this safe environment to develop your own business or your own stream of work, giving this kind of flexibility really makes people more engaged toward your vision and your mission. And also, I think it's about well-being of our employees. I think we need to also work against the culture of making sure people do their time or work hard or work extra hours. I'm actually really against having people do any extra time. I think when people are working extra hours, they get themselves burned out. They get really tired. They get not in a good mental state. And if you're not, there's no way you'll be able to innovate the next day. You need to have a really clarity of mind. You need to be relaxed. You need to be happy and have fun while doing it to bring your whole self to work in order to be the best at innovating.
Wow. I think I'm going to apply to your team. I might be a little older than your normal person, but just to cover, wow. You need to be entrepreneurial. And your motto is fail fast and don't be afraid of failing. Find the weakest link first. And no blaming. And I think, and as you said, keep a work-life balance. It doesn't get any better than this. As I said, amazing. That's how you've been able to bring on a group of 50 AI scientists, which is very, very hard to know. Alex, what are your thoughts on having some diversity and inclusion in the team? What are your thoughts on that?
It's extremely important. I think diversity brings a diversity of thoughts, diversity of approach, and challenge ourselves. I think it's one of our best value as a team, the fact that we have a lot of diversity. We did previously have a good balance, a woman and men. Slowly we lost it. I think we might be at 35% women versus men in the team. Would like to get more. We're working on that. But we do have a lot of diversity of background, of origins, of location as well. We're across Canada. People can work from almost any cities. And I think that's one of our biggest strengths. The fact that we are coming from different background, have different thoughts, and we can challenge each other.
Oh, fantastic. So as you said, diversity is a big strength. How about your thoughts on upskilling and education of your employees? Because as you know, we've talked about, and one of the things you do is this TLDR. Things are moving so crazily rapidly. I mean, do you have anything in place for upskilling or education?
Yeah, we do have a budget for that. And it's open to anyone to use. We're really flexible and we can ask for more money if required. There's a lot of stuff that are free, actually. And I often think those that are free are even better because they are more up to date or timely released. There's a lot of people out there that releases weekly or even daily videos on the new possibilities that this field is opening. When you go to a university for a course or you go to conference, people prepare for 6 months or a year before that. So they will be 6 months or a year late most of the time. So I do encourage a team to go there. I think it's a good jump start to get started in that field. But once you're in that field, to remain updated, you need to really go for yourself, read online, subscribe to newsletter. You need to listen to videos, podcasts, to be really at the frontier.
Well, that's wonderful. So there are some real opportunities for upskilling, etc. Just shifting to what some of your peers and other folks are who are going listening to this, can you tell them, obviously, whatever you can share is some of the key data and infrastructure investments you made to support some of your AI initiatives?
Yeah, so we are in a partnership with Google for 10 years. We're working really closely with them. What really helped us is this migration we did from our internal data lake to the Google Cloud Platform. Having all the information in one place, really structured and validated while we were doing that is really helping us to achieve more efficiency in creating new models and exploring the data, creating analytics out of that. So I think our main investment has been in this partnership with Google, and it's really helping us to accelerate our work. Beside that, we do, as I've mentioned before, work with Microsoft to leverage OpenAI models. They have been really helpful and really low cost for many of our use cases. So I think that would be mostly with Microsoft and Google that we're investing on.
Well, wonderful. Alex, you talked about Microsoft and Google partnerships. Do you have any relationships with academic institutions in terms of research or any other kinds of partnerships with incubators or things of that nature?
Yeah, we did start to work with Vector Institute. I think it's been maybe 6 years or even more. So we work with Vector Institute in Toronto. So that's the AI Institute linked to the University of Toronto. We did also partner up on some initiative and work with EMI from Alberta Machine Intelligence Institute. The one that we've been discussing for a while, but haven't yet started collaboration, we will probably in the next year or so, is MILA in Montreal. Used to be called Montreal Institute of Learning Algorithm, now called Quebec AI Institute. It's the one started by Yoshua Benju in Montreal. So yes, we do partner up with universities and those groups to really help us to attract talent, really help us to create more visibility around our open source project. So it's extremely important for us to partner up with universities.
Wonderful. Alex, there's obviously a lot of conversation going about regarding the ethical considerations surrounding AI. How do you navigate that, especially in a sector like telecommunications, which is highly regulated and you have a lot of personal data, etc.? Tell our listeners, especially your colleagues and peers.
Yeah, actually, we're extremely lucky to have an independent group that reviews anything related to data or to AI. It's called the CTO Office or Data and Trust Office. So we have some partners, some responsible AI team, some data responsible and privacy team that supports every of our projects. So they are always included from the start. They can guide us on the best way to proceed. Let us know if a project is not something we should be doing or not, that there's some risk in there. And we start every project with a data enablement plan. We call it a DEP. That is partly a PIA. So I know a lot of companies are doing PIA. We call it DEP because we're now joining the security and privacy review at the same time. So we're able to be more efficient at doing that, and we can streamline the start of project while discussing with the right folks there. TELUS has always been having the responsible use of AI as one of the key plus value that we're delivering for Canadians. We just won the award, Outstanding Organization Award from the Responsible AI Institute. We're working collaboratively with them, signing and committing to do to use AI in a responsible manner. And we're making that as a key differentiator to be client with TELUS is the fact that you can trust us with our data. We're not selling data. We're using this in a responsible way, and it's overseen by various different independent groups as well.
Wonderful. So you have an ethics group, and you're also are working closely with Responsible AI, Alex. Alex, how do you collaborate with other C-suite leaders to make sure that there is a cohesive enterprise-wide AI strategy? Because now AI is hopefully, at least from the conversations that we have with chief AI officers, it's now got the attention of the board, it's got the attention of the C-suite. Tell our listeners, how do you engage with some of your leaders?
Yeah, we're extremely lucky. In the past year, we actually started to get so much interest in our work that now we had to structure ourselves a little bit better on how we intake those projects and choose which one will be highest priority versus another one. But before that, we had to be more in a push mode, trying to sell that AI can solve a lot of business problems. I deeply believe that 99% of business problems can be enhanced or helped with data. We're collecting so much data today. If you take the time to look through it, you can take better decisions or faster decisions. So we've been, for the last 5 years, really trying to convince people to let us help them. So the switch really happened with this generative AI release and the interest from our executive team to apply AI everywhere. So they started to really see the plus value of that. And we started to move from this push mode to pull mode. So now people are really coming to us with tons of ideas, and we need to choose which one will bring the biggest value for the organization, which one are low-hanging fruits, which one require much more work than others. So in order to do that, we had to organize ourselves a little bit better. And right now what we do is actually, we do a lot of democratization, a lot of presentation, conferences, demos across all business units to show them what is possible and help them think about how AI can help them in their work. And we have an intake form with somebody looking at everything in there, figure out if there are some projects that overlap each other so that we can join them together and develop one solution for for multiple use cases. And we're we have like a, I think we're having right now a 3 to 5 business day SLA to respond to any requests. So we do meet them, explore further their ideas, their data sets, what would be required to deliver the use case. And then we tackle the biggest value that we can generate in the shortest amount of time. But we rarely say no. Actually, I don't even remember any project that came to us that we said no. There's always something we can do. Sometimes it's not the North Star that they had. Sometimes it's a bit better than what they had in mind. But we rarely say no. There's always something we can do to help them out. And even the stuff on the back burner, there's always a way to start something and get iterative value and not delay by multiple months. We normally try within the couple first 2-3 weeks to already have some insights. And having these insights already created, we can already have a better visibility over if a bigger project would be successful or not. It's about learning if the change management would go right. It's about learning if there will be resistance to change, the willingness to really change their ways of working. So we can test that quickly with some insights already after a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's great. So obviously, there is a lot of visibility with the C-suite. You're very responsive, turn things around, never say no. And obviously, I'm sure the C-suite people like that. Alex, tell us a little bit about the different tools that are being used in AI, machine learning, natural language processing. Tell our listeners, your peers, etc., what all TELUS is using.
Yeah, for sure. I think, again, that's one of the key differentiator that we would have versus other tech companies. We're touching them all. We're actually using all the technologies out there that are available. So from deep learning for computer vision, audio transcripts, to NLP and LLM for generative AI use case and Copilot, a lot of machine learning as well for marketing use cases or for network proactive assistance. The only technology I would say we used a little bit less, but that might change in the short future, is the reinforcement learning technologies. So we used it on HVAC, the solution I've mentioned before for optimizing the cost of cooling and heating our data centers. But we haven't used it yet for our better routing of traffic, for example, or for dynamic pricing. Like, there's multiple other use cases we could be doing with reinforcement learning that we haven't tackled yet. But beside reinforcement learning, we've been using almost all of those technologies.
Wow. So, hey, if you come in, you'll get to use almost everything except reinforcement learning. So that's another attraction for people to come in. Alex, how do you assess the business impact and ROI of some of the AI programs? I mean, a lot of people are saying it's hard to assess, but there's a lot of high returns. How do you track performance over time?
Totally. Our most important metric is the ROI. So we are never after output, but after outcome. So the role of our team doesn't stop at delivering an insight or delivering a machine learning model. Even if the data science metrics are really good, like it's the most precise model you can have out there, if the business is not using it and changing the process and creating value out of that, we're not successful as a team. So we're really an end-to-end AI provider that are after outcome. We're trying to measure ourselves always on EBITDA generated for the company, so cost saving or revenue increases. And sometimes it's easy to test. Sometimes it's a little bit more complex. So if we take marketing campaigns as an example, quite easy. We can do A-B testing, validate with the group that we tackle versus another group that we didn't, and see how stuff has changed and easily calculate the return on the investment. That being said, on other projects, it could be harder. For fraud, detecting the fraud that were prevented, we can also calculate how many of those the model detected, how many we prevented. We could do A-B testing there as well. But it gets a little bit more complex. And some other use cases are more about saving time or being more efficient in their work. So if we speak about the generative AI use case, It's sometimes a little bit more tough to understand if people that are saving time are actually giving this time back to the company. So you could save somebody 1 hour of their time in the day. Are they being more productive during this new hour? Or are they going out to walk their dog? So it's all a bit more tough and some time to really figure out like what's the gain of productivity we're getting there. But we do work closely with them and have a team dedicated to measure the plus value. Again, an independent team, they are not reporting to me, that would review like how was that helpful for the business.
So you have many different criteria to evaluate the ROI. You know, it could be time saving, it could be customer retention, etc. So that's great to know. What are some of the emerging trends that you are seeing in AI, or what you see will be coming up in AI, especially in your industry, Alex?
Yeah, and the you did mention one before, actually, the having integration of LLM into end user devices. That will be quite interesting. So instead of hosting them on the core network and having a latency created through that, I think hosting models directly in your device will bring up tons of new applications. So that will be an interesting one. There's also more orchestration tool that will be required eventually. So one of the challenges I'm hearing is we have a huge network. Sometimes wireline overlaps with wireless on the core for internet access, with a lot of different teams working on different components, virtual network, more in the configuration, and physical network of optic fiber and copper and all of that. So sometimes a change is tough to link to another one. So somebody doing a logical change while somebody's doing a physical change, how will they impact our customer at the end? We don't want to create an outage. We don't want to impact the same customer twice in the same day. And it's tough right now to facilitate the communication between those teams. So eventually, AI will become an orchestrator, will look at everything happening on the network, and will be able to raise alarm that say, hey, those two teams are working in the same link here. Be careful. They should communicate to each other, or we should delay one change versus the other one. So those kind of orchestrator will be helpful a lot on telcos and making changes on either the core or the random access network.
Wonderful. So small form factors, orchestration, some of the things that are coming down. Alex, you covered a lot of ground. Some of these large organizations that are, you know, looking to establish a chief AI officer role or build out their AI capabilities, what would be some of the key lessons that you have learned in your journey, and what advice would you give to some of these organizations?
Yeah, I think one of the main things that we've learned through time that really differentiated us from peers that I've been discussing in the industry, I wouldn't say that it was a genius move that we made ourselves. I think it was just circumstances that created that. But one of our biggest gains was that to have the trust from the finance team. Some companies are working toward getting an ROI on each single project. So they start a project, they ask for $1 million to fund the project, they work on the project, and then finance comes back and asks, what's the return? Like, how much value could you create out of this million I gave you? I don't think that's the right way to tackle this. As I've mentioned before, this field is more research and development. It's more risky. One project is a toss of a coin. So if ever you work that way, finance will fund the first project, maybe the second one, maybe the third one, but eventually they will catch up and figure out, hey, I'm not getting the return on each of those individual projects, so I will put my money away and not on other stuff. So what we had the chance to build with finance is to build a full trust. So what we're telling them is fund our team, fund our requirements. At the end of the year, we will be giving you this amount of return. So we're calculating again on outcome, on EBITDA generation. We would start a year and say, this year, for example, we need $5 million, but we'll generate $20 million EBITDA out of that. And we'll try that. We'll get your approval, make sure that this is all kosher. But we're not funding individual projects. So we can fund 99 0.9% of our projects, if we want, as long as the 0.1% will be generating this 50 million that we're trying to get, we're successful at the end of the year. So that's how we should measure success, not the success of individual project, but the success of the team altogether. So that really ties to our fail fast approach. I think it really helped us to be successful and scale in that field.
So I think what Alex's message to others who are trying to set up a chief AI officer role or implement AI across is look at it from the big picture perspective, not just silo projects, and the success will come over time, and have a little more patience. I think that's what, Alex, you're saying. Alex, I could go on and on and on because there's so many things that we want to know. But generally, towards the end, we do a very quick lightning round of questions. Just get some brief answers from you in 2-3 sentences for our listeners who really are curious about you. Can you, you said obviously this is a field where you have to learn a lot and you have to stay on top of technology and what's happening. What book, newsletter, podcast, or resource would you recommend to someone who wants to learn more about AI, and especially the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, as I've been mentioning before, like books, it takes time to write them. Once they are published, they are already 2 years late. So if you want to get started, for sure books can be good. But if you're already in that field, I think newsletters are even more important. One I personally prefer is the TLDR AI one. So if you look for TLDR newsletter AI, you receive a daily newsletter summarizing all the different big releases, either research, GitHub, or products, and they link to further article if that's something that interests you. That's mostly where I'm getting my information today.
Wow, wonderful. Alex said books, by the time they publish, they're obsolete. He gets his news from newsletters. TLDR is a great source. What's the one piece of advice you wish you'd gotten when you were just starting out in your AI career, Alex?
So I think the most challenging part of AI project is not the technology itself, but the change management. And that's something we had to learn the hard way. It's about being able to educate people, convince them, avoid resistance to change. Most of the time, it's more important even than finding the right technology. Getting really good accuracy metrics or any other data science metrics is convincing engineers and data science enthusiasts, but doesn't convince the business. What convinces them is really showing the plus value and helping them understand how this technology was built. So what I would tell me is actually focus on educating, convincing, and then avoiding resistance to change, the human aspect more than the technology aspect.
So the human aspect more than the technology aspect. Alex, your thoughts on the potential long-term implications of AGI or artificial general intelligence and its impact on society, and by which I mean is when machines get smarter than humans in general terms.
Yeah, my biggest fear is not necessarily AGI, but how bad actors can use AI, even those that are already available today. So AGI will be just another even better tool that bad actors might be able to use. So my fear is not AGI itself, but how people will use it. Already today, we see how generative AI and deepfakes can really destroy reputation and create a lot of fear and uncertainty, and even influence voters, challenge democracies. So I'm more afraid about how humans will use it than AGI itself.
So how humans would use AGI? I think that's a very, very good point. Alex, if you could have dinner with any AI luminary, and there are many of them, Turing Award winners, etc., living or deceased, who would it be?
That would be Yoshua Bengio. So one of the godfather of AI. He's actually based in Montreal. I've been meeting him a couple of times already and been to many of his conferences. I love the fact that first he stayed in Canada, stayed in research, didn't buy into those crazy offers he received from the big tech companies. And I love how he's having deep thoughts on how the field will impact our society and how we should start to prevent the blast radius that technologies like AGI could have on the society, how to do that in a responsible way. So I think Yoshio Bendu is extremely interesting. So that will be my choice.
Great choice. Agree with that. Final words, Alex, for our audience, or recommendations do you have for our listeners who are, you know, on their journey? Some of them are your colleagues, your peers. What would be your final words to our audience?
Yeah, I think I would actually wrap this up. I think we'll close a circle here. You need to stay humble and brace yourself for a lifelong learning journey. You'll never be able to sit on your laurels. You can become an expert at the various things. At AI, you'll always need to challenge yourself and continue to learn to remain on the top. AI disrupts itself every single day. So if you go into this field, don't do it because of the hype. Do it because you're passionate about this and you want to constantly learn about that.
Great points. Be humble and be passionate. Alex, thanks so much for your insightful input. Your journey, sharing some insights, the challenges, the opportunities. Really, in terms of why TELUS is a great place, what you look for, some of the things that you're doing, will be very helpful to the peers. Really grateful for you taking the time, and really wish you a lot of success as you shape the future of AI at TELUS, and really helping inspire others who want to follow in this journey. So thank you to our listeners for tuning in to the CIO podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the leaders like Alex who are driving AI innovation forward. So stay tuned for more captivating conversations with chief AI officers from across industries. Thank you. Goodbye. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks so much.